honour, and I mean no offence. Truly, Gennaro, we've asked for a favour tomorrow in exchange for promises that will take months or years to fully play out. I doubt you could find two people in Aspara more difficult to offend than Verina or myself at this moment. You're both so well-spoken, said Bulidazi. I can see why you'd want to dabble on the stage. But now let me have your confidence. Your cousin has an aspect that blossoms upon consideration. When she entered this room, she was merely pretty, but after watching her, listening to her, I feel as though the air has been taken straight out of my lungs. Locke felt as though the air had been taken straight out of his lungs. Tell me, please, said Bulidazi, clearly noticing the change in Locke's demeanor as Locke fought for self-control. Does she really love the theater and blade work? She, lives for them, said Locke. Are you betrothed to her? Locke was overwhelmed by a flurry of immediate reactions. The urge to stand up, say yes, slap Bulidazi across the face, grab him by his hair, and dig wide furrows in the felt of his billiards table using his teeth. Then came the secondary calculations like a bucket of cold water. Bulidazi would kill him. Sabatho would gladly help. The intrusion of his personal jealousy into his professional character would doom the gentleman bastards to utter failure. No, he said, almost calmly. No, I've been meant for someone else, since I was barely old enough to walk. We'll wed when she comes of age. And Verina, said Bulidazi. Another less than helpful flash from Locke's imagination, protesting what his higher reasoning knew to be unavoidable. Jean Tannen smashing in through a back door, hoisting Bulidazi over his head, slamming him down across the billiards table. Why were all his fantasies so calamitous for that table, which had done him no injury? And God's damn it anyway, it was never going to happen. Unattached, said Locke, hating the word even as he brought it forth. Father and grandfather have always felt that Verina is a fruit best left hanging, until they know how she might be most advantageously plucked. Thank you, said the Baron. Thank you. That's welcome news. I hope you won't think of me as grasping beyond my station, Lucasa. I come from a long and honorable line. I hold several estates with secure incomes. I've much to offer by way of a match. I'm sure you do, said Locke slowly. Were she pleased, and with Count Blackspear's consent? Yes, yes, with the family's blessing. And were she pleased? Bulidazi ran a hand through his hair and made nervous, meaningless adjustments to his white silk neckcloth. I'll do it, Lugaza. I'll forgive Moncrane, and trust you to keep him under my thumb. I'll provide whatever you need to settle his debts and tame his troop. All I ask... Yes? Help me, said Bulidazi. Help me show Verina my quality, my honorable intentions. Teach me how I might better please her. Advise her favorably on my behalf. If Moncrane goes free... He will, said Bulidazi. He won't be at the Weeping Tower a moment longer than he has to be. Then I am your man, said Locke softly, fighting back further visions of Gennaro Bulidazi spitting up fragments of his billiards table. I am for you, my friend. Chapter 7. The Five-Year Game. Countermove. 1. What the hell's the matter with us, Jean? Locke rubbed his eyes and noticed certain discomforts in his gut and around his ankles, in that order. She's rolled us up like a couple of old tents, and what the fuck are these things on my legs? Just above his feet, his thin, pale ankles were encircled by bands of iron. The manacles were loose enough to let blood flow, but weighed about 5 pounds apiece. I imagine they're to discourage us from swimming, said Jean. Aren't they thoughtful? They match your eyes. The bars across the windows aren't enough, eh? Gods above, my stomach feels like it's trying to eat the rest of me. Locke made a more thorough examination of their surroundings. Cushions, shelves, silks, and lanterns. The cabin was fit for the Duke of Camor. There was even a little rack of books and scrolls next to Jean. Look what she left sitting out for us, said Jean. He tossed Locke the leather-bound book he'd been reading. It was an aged quarto with gold leaf alchemically embossed into three lines on the cover. The Republic of Thieves. A True and Tragic History. Caelius Lucano. "Ooh," said Locke softly, setting the book aside. "That beauty has a bitch streak as wide as 10 rivers. How'd she drug you?" said Jean. "Quite embarrassingly." There was a knock at the cabin door. It opened a moment later, and down the steps came a spry, long-legged fellow with the tan of many active years sunk into his lean features. "Hello, boys," said the stranger. He had a faint Ferrari accent. "Welcome aboard the Volantine's Resolve. Solus Volantine at your service. And I do mean that. You boys are our first and only business on this trip." "Whatever you're being paid," said Locke, "we can double it if you turn this ship around right now." "Our mutual friend told me that was probably the first thing you'd say, Master Lazari." Locke cracked his knuckles and glared. He had to give Sabatha credit for at least preserving their false identities, but he didn't want to have any kind thoughts toward her at the moment. "I'm inclined to agree with her suggestion," continued Volantine, "that I'm rather more likely to enjoy success and fair compensation in partnership with the woman who's still at liberty, rather than the two men she brought to me in chains." "We can triple her payment," said Locke. "A man who'd trade a sure fortune for the promises of an angry prisoner is far too stupid to be the captain of his own ship," said Volantine. "Well, hells," said Locke, "if you want turncoat, can you at least get me some ship's biscuit or something? Our mutual friend said that food would be the second thing on your mind." Volantine folded his arms and smiled. "But we're not eating ship's biscuit on this leg of the trip. We're eating fresh-baked pepper bread and goose stuffed with honey-glazed olives and boiled lake frogs in brandy and cream." "I got hit on the head somehow," said Locke. "This is the stupidest dream I've had in years, isn't it?" "No dream, my friend. We've been set up with a cook so good I'd fuck him 6 days a week just to keep him aboard, if only I liked men. But he's another gift paid for by our mutual friend. Come on deck and let me explain the conditions of your passage, you lucky, lucky sons of bitches." On deck, Locke could see that the Volantine's Resolve was a two-masted brig with her rigging in good order. Her sails were neither straight from the yard nor frayed to threads. About 2 dozen men and women had been formed up to watch Locke and Jean emerge from the great cabin. Most of them had the tan, rangy look of sailors, but a few of the heavier ones, big-boned land animals for sure, looked like freshly hard muscle. "This is the easiest cruise we've ever been given," said Volantine. "We're headed west, up the Cavendria, and out to sea. We'll have an autumn excursion for a month, then we'll turn round and take it slow and easy back to Carthane. You gentlemen will enjoy a luxurious cabin, books to read, fine meals. The wines we've laid in for the voyage will make you think you're royalty. All this on one condition only. Good behavior." "I can pay," said Locke, raising his voice to a shout, "3 times what each of you is receiving now. You would have it merely for getting us back to Carthane. 2 days' work rather than 2 months." "Now, sir," said Volantine, looking cross for the first time, "that's not good behavior at all. Any further talk in that vein will get you sent down to the hold. There's 2 ways to make this trip, with free limbs and full stomachs, or cinched up tight in darkness, let out once a day to eat and piss. I'm to take the tenderest care with your lives, but your liberty can go straight overboard if you give us trouble." "What about these things around our ankles?" said Locke. "Shields from temptation," said Volantine. "Gah!" Locke muttered. "Also, where's this food?"
"Sirs, 1,000 apologies,
cried a man in a stained brown robe who came tumbling up from below via the main deck hatch. He was pale, with greyish-blonde hair, and carried a silver tray set with a plain iron tureen and several loaves of bread.
"I have the foods."
"This famous cook of yours is a vadron?" said Jean.
"Yes, I know," said Volantine. "But you must trust me. Adalric was trained in Talisham, and he knows his business. The oysters in sauce from ale has I boiled, said the cook. He held the tray out to Locke, and the scents of fresh food were as good as a fist to the jaw. Discussion of the situation, said Locke, can recommence in about half an hour. So long as you quit trying to bribe my crew, you may speak as you please, honored passengers, said Valentine. 2. As the first day passed, and the second, it became clear that their situation was both the most comfortable and the most vexing imprisonment Locke could have imagined. Their meals were plentiful and magnificent, the wine better even than promised, the ale fresh and sweet, and their requests were taken up without hesitation or complaint.
"These bastards have made their fortunes on this venture," said Jean, over the remnants of lunch on the second day. "Isn't that right, shipmates? It's the only possible explanation for our treatment. A pile of gold in every pocket."
Every meal was eaten in the presence of at least four attendants, silent and polite and utterly vigilant. Every knife and fork was counted. Every scrap and bone was collected. Locke could have palmed any number of useful items, but there was no point to it, not until the other difficulties of their situation could be surmounted. Their bedding was turned out and replaced each day, and they were kept on deck while it happened. Locke could see just enough of the activity within the cabin to depress his spirits. All of their books were given a shake, their chests were opened and searched, their hammocks scoured, the floor planks examined in minute detail. By the time they were let back in, everything was restored to its proper place, and the cabin was as fresh as if it had never been used, but it was useless to hide anything. They were searched several times each day, and weren't even permitted to wear shoes. The only extraneous object they possessed, in fact, was Jean's tightly bound lock of Ezri's hair. Locke was surprised to see it on the morning of their third day.
"I had a few words with Sabitha after her people finally knocked me down."
Jean lay in his hammock, idly turning the hair over and over in his hands.
"She said that some courtesies were not to be refused."
"Did she say anything else? About me? Or for me?"
"I think she's said everything she means to say, Locke. This ship's as good as a farewell note.
She must have given Valentine and his crew 10 pages of directions concerning us. Even their little boat is lashed tighter than usual, as though some god might reach down and snatch it off the deck," said Jean casually.
"Oh, really?"
Locke slipped out of his hammock, crept over to Jean's side of the cabin and lowered his voice.
"On the larboard side of the main deck? You think we could make something of it?" "We'd never have time to hoist it properly. But if we could weaken the ropes, and if the deck was pitching..."
"Shit," said Locke. "Once we hit the Cavendria, we'll be steady as a cup of tea until we're out the other side. How many of our friends do you figure we could handle at once?"
"How many could I handle at once? Let's be pragmatic and say 3. I'm pretty sure I could club the whole crew down 1 or 2 at a time if nobody raised an alarm, but you've seen their habits. They never work alone. I'm not sure the brute force approach will get us very far."
"You know, it certainly would be nice to receive an unannounced visit from our benefactor Patience," said Locke, "or anyone associated with her. Right about now. Or now."
"I think we're on our own," said Jean. "I'm sure someone or something is watching us, but Sabitha put us here. It seems within the rules as Patience explained them.
I wonder if her bonds, Magi, would be so sporting."
"Well, there is a bright side. We're eating well enough. You're not looking like such a wrenched-out noodle anymore."
"That's great, Jean. I'm not just exiled. I'm being plumped up for slaughter. Suppose there's any chance we might run into Zamira if we reach the Sea of Brass?"
"What the hell would she be doing back up here so soon after everything that happened?"
Jean yawned and stretched.
"The poison orchid's as likely to come over the horizon and save us as I am to give birth to a live albatross."
"It was just an idle thought," said Locke. "A damned pleasing idle thought. So, I suppose we pray for heavy weather."
"And worry about cutting some ropes," said Jean. "Ideas?"
"I could have a makeshift knife on an hour's notice, so long as I knew it would be used before they turned our cabin over the next day."
"Good. And what about our ankle manacles? You've always been better with that sort of thing than I have.
The mechanisms are delicate. I could come up with bone splinters small enough to fit, but those are brittle. One snap and they'd jam up the locks for good.
Then we might just have to bear them until we can hit land, said Jean. Well, first things first. We need to be within reasonable distance of a beach, and we need a rolling deck, and we need to not be tied up in the hold when our chance comes.
3. The sky turned grey again that night, and ominous clouds boiled on the horizons, but the gentle rolling of the Amethel barely tilted the deck of the Resolve in one direction or another. Locke spent several hours leaning against the main deck rails, feigning placidity, straining secretly for any glimpse of a bolt of lightning or an oncoming thunderhead. The only lights to be seen, however, were the ghostly flickerings from within the black depths of the lake, twinkling like constellations of fire. Their progress was slow. The strange autumn winds were against them much of the time, and with no mages to shape the weather to their taste, they had to move by tack after long, slow tack to the southwest. Valentine and his crew seemed to care not a whit. Whether they sailed half the world or half a mile, their pay would be the same. On the night of their fourth day, Locke caught flashes of whitish yellow illuminating the southern horizon, but his excitement died when he realized that he was looking at Lashane. On the fifth day they picked up speed, and the capricious winds grew stronger. The whole sky bruised over with promising clouds, and just after noon the first drops of cool rain began to fall. Locke and Jean retreated to their cabin, trying to look innocent. They buried themselves in books and idle conversation, glancing out the cabin window every few moments, watching in mutual satisfaction as the troughs between the waves deepened and the strands of foam thickened at their crests. At the third hour of the afternoon, with the rain steady and the lake rolling at 4 or 5 feet, Adelric came to their door to receive instructions for dinner.
"Perhaps the soup of the veal, masters?"
"By all means," said Locke. If any chance to escape was coming, he wanted to face it with at least one more of the Vadran prodigy's feasts shoved down his gullet.
"And how about chicken?" said Jean.
"I'll do one the murder right away."
"Dessert, too," said Locke. "Let's have a big one tonight. Storms make me hungry."
"I have a cake of the honey and ginger," said Adelric.
"Good man," said Jean. "And let's have some wine. 2 bottles of sparkling apple, eh?"
2 bottles, said the cook. "I has it brung to you."
"Decent fellow, for all that he tramples the language," said Locke when the door had closed behind the cook. "I hate to take advantage of him."
"He won't miss us if we slip away," said Jean. "He's got the whole crew to appreciate him. You know what sort of slop they'd be gagging down if he wasn't aboard."
Locke went on deck a few minutes later, letting the rain soak him as he stood by the foremast, feigning indifference as the deck rolled slowly from side to side. It was a gentle motion as yet, but if the weather continued to pick up, it was a very promising trend indeed.
"Master Lazari!"
Solus Valentine came down from the quarter-deck, oil-cloak fluttering.
"Surely you'd be more comfortable in your cabin. Perhaps our mutual friend neglected to tell you, Captain Valentine, that Master Callus and myself have been at sea. Compared to what we endured down in the ghost winds, this is invigorating."
"I do know something of your history, Lazari, but I'm also charged with your safety."
"Well, until someone takes these damned bracelets off my ankles, I can't exactly swim to land, can I?"
"And what if you catch cold?"
"With Adelric aboard, he must have possets that would drive back death itself. Will you at least consent to an oil cloak, so you look like less of a crazy landsman?"
"That'd be fine."
Valentine summoned a sailor with a spare cloak, and Locke resumed talking as he fastened it over his shoulders.
"Now, pardon my ignorance, but where the hell are we, anyway?"
40 miles due west of Lashane, give or take a hair in any direction."
"Ah, I thought I spotted the city last night. We're not making good westward progress. If I had a schedule to keep, I'd be in a black mood. But thanks to you, we're in no hurry, are we?"
"Quite. Are those heavier storms to the south?"
"That shadow? That's a lee shore, Master Lazari. A damned lee shore. We're 8 or 9 miles off the southern coast of the Amethel, and fighting to get no closer. If we can punch through this mess and claw another 20 or 30 miles west-northwest, we should be clear straight to the Cavendria. And from there it's like a wading pond all the way to the Sea of Brass.
Well, that's good to hear, said Locke. Rest assured, I've got absolutely no interest in drowning.
4. Dinner was excellent and productive. 4 of Valentine's sailors watched from the corners of the cabin while Locke and Jean packed away soup, chicken, bread, cake, and sparkling apple wine. Just after opening the second bottle, however, Locke signalled Jean that he was about to have a clumsy moment. Timing himself to the sway of the ship, Locke swept the new bottle off the table. It landed awkwardly and broke open, spilling cold, frothing wine across his bare feet. Realizing that the bottle hadn't shattered into the selection of knife-like shards he'd hoped for, he managed to drop his wine glass as well, with more satisfactory results.
"Ah, shit, that was good stuff," he said loudly, slipping off his chair and crouching above the mess.
He waved his hands over it as though unsure of what to do, and in an instant a long, sturdy piece of glass was shifted from his palm to his tunic sleeve. It was delicate work. A red stain beneath the cloth would surely draw attention.
"Don't," said one of the sailors, waving for one of his companions to go on deck. "Don't touch anything. We'll get it for you."
Locke put his hands up and took several careful steps back.
"I'd call for more wine," said Jean, hoisting his own glass teasingly, "but it's possible you've had enough."
"That was the motion of the ship," said Locke.
The missing guard returned with a brush and a metal pan. He quickly swept up all the fragments.
"We'll scrub the deck when we give the cabin a turn tomorrow, sir," said one of the sailors.
"At least it smells nice," said Locke.
The guards didn't search him. Locke admired the deepening darkness through the cabin window and allowed himself the luxury of a faint smirk. When the remains of dinner were cleared, every knife and fork and spoon accounted for, and the cabin was his and Jean's again, Locke carefully drew out the shard of glass and set it on the table.
"Doesn't look like much," said Jean.
"It needs some binding," said Locke, "and I know just where to get it."
While Jean leaned against the cabin door, Locke used the glass shard to carefully worry the inside front cover of the copy of the Republic of Thieves. After a few minutes of slicing and peeling, he produced an irregular patch of the binding leather and a quantity of the cord that had gone into the spine of the volume. He nestled the glass fragment inside the leather and wrapped it tightly around the edges, creating something like a tiny handsaw. The leather-bound side could be safely nestled against the palm of a hand, and the cutting edge of the shard could be worked against whatever needed slicing.
"Now," said Locke softly, holding his handiwork up to the lantern light and examining it with a mixture of pride and trepidation, "shall we take a turn on deck and enjoy the weather?"
The weather had worsened agreeably to a hard driving autumn rain. The Amethel was whipped up to waves of 6 or 7 feet, and lightning flashed behind the ever-moving clouds. Locke and Jean, both wearing oil cloaks, settled down against the inner side of the jolly boat lashed upside down to the main deck. It was about 15 feet long, of the sort usually hung at a ship's stern. Locke supposed that the urgent need to put the iron bars around the windows of the great cabin had forced the crew to shift the boat. It was secured to the deck via lines and ring bolts. Nothing that a crew of sailors couldn't deal with in just a few minutes, but if he and Jean tried to free the boat conventionally, it would take far too long to escape notice. Cutting was the answer. Weaken the critical lines, wait for a fortuitous roll of the ship, heave the jolly boat loose, and then somehow join it after it pitched over the side. Jean sat placidly while Locke worked with the all-important glass shard. 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 20 minutes. Locke's oil cloak was a blessing, making it possible to conceal the activity, but the need to hold the arm and shoulder still put all the burden on wrist and forearm. Locke worked until he ached, then carefully passed the shard to Jean.
"You two seem strangely heedless of the weather," shouted Valentine, moving past with a lantern.
He studied them, his eyes flicking here and there for anything out of place. Eventually he relaxed, and Locke's heart resumed its usual duties.
"We're still warm from dinner, Captain," said Jean. and we've lived through storms on the Sea of Brass. This is a fine diversion from the monotony of our cabin.
Monotony, perhaps, but also security. You may remain for now, so long as you continue to stay out of the way. We'll have business with the sails soon enough. If we find ourselves much closer to shore, I shall require you to go below.
Having problems? Said Locke.
Damned nuisance of a wind from the north and the northwest. Seems to veer however's least convenient. We're 5 miles off the beach, where we should be 10.
We are your most loyal and devoted articles of ballast, Captain, said Locke. Let us digest a bit longer and maybe we'll scuttle back inside.
As soon as Valentine stepped away, Locke felt Jean get back to work.
We don't have much time, muttered Jean, and one or two uncut lines are as good as 20. Some things don't break for any man's strength.
I've done some real damage to my side, said Locke. All we can do is keep it up as long as possible.
The minutes passed. Sailors came and went on deck, checking for faults everywhere but directly behind the two men working desperately to cause one. The ship rolled steadily from side to side, lightning flared on every horizon, and Locke found himself growing more and more tense as the minutes passed. If this failed, he had no doubt that Valentine's threat to seal them up in one of the holds would be carried out immediately.
"Oh, hells," muttered Jean. "Feel that?"
"Feel what?"
"Oh, damn."
The ship had tilted to starboard, and the weight of the jollyboat was pressing more firmly against Locke's back and shoulders. The lines holding it down were starting to give way sooner than he'd expected.
"What the hell do we do now?"
"Hold on," muttered Jean.
The ship tilted to larboard, and there was the faintest scraping noise against the deck. Locke prayed that the tumult of the weather would drown it out for anyone not sitting directly against the boat. Like a pendulum, the ship swung to starboard again, and this time the scraping noise rose to a screech. The press against Locke's back became ominous, and something snapped loudly just behind him.
"Shit!"
whispered Jean.
"Up and over!"
The two gentlemen bastards turned and scrambled over the back of the jolly boat at the moment its restraints completely gave way. Locke and Jean rolled off the boat with an embarrassing want of smoothness, landed hard, and the jolly boat took off across the deck, screeching and sliding toward the starboard rail.
"Ha-ha!" Locke yelled, unable to contain himself. "We're off!"
The jolly boat slammed against the starboard rail and came to a dead stop.
"Balls!"
said Locke, not quite as loudly. An instant later, the ship heeled to larboard, and Locke realized that he and Jean were directly in the only path the jolly boat could take when it slid back down the tilting deck. He gave Jean a hard shove to the left and rolled clear the other way. A moment later, the boat scraped and scudded across the deck between them, gathering momentum as it went. Locke turned, certain that it should go over the side this time. With a creaking thump, the boat landed hard against the larboard rail. Although the rail bent, it didn't give way completely, and the upside-down boat remained very much out of the water.
"Perelandro's dangling cock!"
Locke yelled, lurching to his feet.
"What the hells do you two think you're doing?"
Solus Valentine came leaping adroitly across the main deck, lantern still in hand.
"Your boat's come free! Help us!"
yelled Jean. A moment later, he seemed to think better of subterfuge, walloped Valentine across the jaw with a right hook, and grabbed the lantern as the captain went down.
"Jean, behind you!"
Locke yelled, dodging the boat for a second time as the deck tilted yet again. A crewman had come up behind Jean with a belaying pin in hand. Jean sidestepped the man's first attack and cracked the lantern across the top of his head. Glass shattered, and glowing white alchemical slime sprayed across the poor fellow from forehead to waist. It was generally harmless stuff, but nothing you wanted in your eyes. Moaning and glowing like a ghost out of some fairy story, the man fell against the foremast. In front of Locke, the jolly boat slid to starboard, hit the rail at speed, crashed through with a terrible splintering noise, and went over the side.
"Thank the gods!"
Locke muttered as he ran to the gap in the rail, just in time to see the boat plunge bow first into the water like an arrowhead and get immediately swallowed beneath a crashing wave.
"Oh, come on!"
"Jump!"
hollered Jean, ducking a swing from a crewman who came at him with an oar. Jean slammed two punches into the unfortunate sailor's ribs, and the man did a convincing imitation of a marionette with its strings cut.
"Get the hell in the water! The boat sank!"
Locke cried, scanning the darkness in vain for a glimpse of it. Whistles were sounding from the quarterdeck and from within the ship. The whole crew would be roused against them presently.
"I don't see it!" "Can't hear you! Jump!"
Jean dashed across the deck and gave Locke a well-meaning shove through the gap in the railing. There was no time to do anything but gasp in a surprised breath. Locke's oilcloth fluttered around him as he fell like a wounded bat into the dark water of the Amethel. The cold hit like a shock. He whirled within the churning blackness, fighting against his cloak and the weight of his ankle manacles. They weren't dragging him straight down, but they would sharply increase the rate at which he would exhaust himself by kicking to keep his head up. His face broke the surface. He choked in a breath of air and fresh water spray. The Volantine's resolve loomed over him like a monstrous shadow, lit by the shuddering light of a dozen jumping, bobbing lanterns. A familiar dark shape detached itself from some sort of fight against the near rail and fell toward the water.
"Jean!" Locke sputtered. "There's no—"
The lost boat resurfaced like a broaching shark, spat up in a gushing white torrent. Jean landed on it face first with a ghastly thump and splashed heavily into the water beside it.
"Jean!"
Locke screamed, grabbing hold of one of the jolly boat's gunwales and desperately scanning the water for any sign of his friend. The bigger man had already sunk beneath the surface. A wave crashed over Locke's head and tore at his hold on the boat. He spat water and searched desperately. There, a dim shape drifted 6 or 7 feet beneath Locke's toes, lit from below by an eerie blue-white light. Locke dove just as another breaking wave hammered the boat. Locke grabbed Jean by the collar and felt cold dismay at the feeble response. For a moment it seemed that the two of them hung suspended in a grey netherworld between lurching wave-tops and ghostly light, and Locke suddenly realized the source of the illumination around them. Not lightning or lanterns, but the unknown fires that burned at the very bottom of the Amethel. Glimpsed underwater, they lost their comforting, jewel-like character, and seemed to roil and pulse and blur. They stung Locke's eyes, and his skin crawled with the unreasonable instinctive sensation that something utterly hostile was nearby, nearby and drawing closer. He hooked his hands under Jean's arms and kicked mightily, heaving the two of them back toward the surface and the storm. He scraped his cheek against the jolly boat as he came up, sucked in a deep breath, and heaved at Jean again to get the larger man's head above water. The cold was like a physical pressure, numbing Locke's fingers and slowly turning his limbs to lead.
"Come back to me, Jean!" Locke spat. "I know your brains are jarred, but Crooked Warden, come back!"
He yanked at Jean, holding on to the gunwale of the wave-tossed boat with his other hand, and for all his pains succeeded only in nearly capsizing it again.
"Shit!"
Locke needed to get in first, but if he let Jean go, Jean would probably sink again. He spotted the rowing lock, the U-shaped piece of cast iron set into the gunwale to hold an oar. It had been smashed by the boat's slides across the deck, but it might serve a new purpose. Locke seized Jean's oilcloak and twisted one end into a crude knot around the bent rowing lock, so that Jean hung from the boat by his neck and chest. Not a sensible way to leave him, but it would keep him from drifting away while Locke got on board. A fresh wave knocked the side of the boat against Locke's head. Black spots danced before his eyes, but the pain goaded him to furious action. He plunged into the blackness beneath the boat, then clawed his way up to the gunwale on the opposite side. Another wave struck, and out of its froth Locke scrabbled and strained until he was over the edge. He bounced painfully off a rowing bench and flopped into the ankle-deep water sloshing around the bottom. Locke reached over the side and grabbed Jean. His heaving was desperate, unbalanced, and useless. The little boat bobbled and shook with every effort, rising and falling on the waves like a piston in some nightmarish machine. At last Locke's wits punched through the walls of his exhaustion and panic. He turned Jean sideways and hauled him in a foot and an arm at a time, using his oilcloak for added leverage. Once he was safely in, the bigger man coughed and mumbled and flopped around.
"Oh, I hate the Eldrin, Jean!"
Locke gasped as they lay in the bottom of the tossing boat, lashed by waves and rain.
"I hate him! I hate whatever they did. I hate the shit they left behind. I hate the way none of their mysteries ever turn out to be pleasant and fucking good neighborly.
Pretty lights, muttered Jean.
Yeah, pretty lights, Locke spat. Friendly sailors, the Amethel has it all.
Locke nudged Jean aside and sat up. They were bobbing around like a wine cork in a cauldron set to boil, but now that their weight was in the center of the little boat, it seemed better able to bear the tossing. They had drifted astern and inshore of the Volantine's Resolve, which was now more than 50 yards away. Confused shouts could be heard, but the ship didn't seem to be putting about to come after them. Locke could only hope that Jean's cold cocking of Volantine would prevent the rest of the crew from getting things together until it was too late.
"Holy hells," said Jean. "How did I get here?"
"Never mind that. You see any oars?"
"I think I beat the crap out of the guy that had them."
Jean reached up and gingerly prodded his face.
"Oh, gods, I think I broke my nose again."
"You used it to break your fall when you hit the boat."
"Is that what hit me?"
"Yeah, scared me shitless."
"You saved me."
"It's my turn every couple of years," said Locke with a thin smile.
"Thank you."
"All I did was save my own ass 4 or 5 times down the line," said Locke, "and cut you in on a hell of a landing. If the waves keep taking us south, we should hit the beach in just a few miles, but without any oars to keep ourselves under control, it might be a hard way to leave the water."
The waves did their part, bearing their little boat south at a frightful clip, and when the beach finally came into sight, their arrival went as hard as Locke had guessed. The Amethel flung them against the black volcanic sand like some monster vomiting up a plaything that had outlasted its interest. 5. The coastal road west of La Chaine was called the Dark Sands Stretch, and it was a lonely place to be travelling this windy autumn morning. A single coach, pulled by a team of 8 horses, trundled along the centuries-old stones, raising spurts of wet gravel in its wake, rather than the clouds of dust more common in drier seasons. The secure coach service from Salon-Corbeau and points farther south was for rich travellers unable to bear the thought of setting foot aboard a ship. With iron-bound doors, shuttered windows, and interior locks, the carriage was a little fortress for passengers afraid of highwaymen. The driver wore an armoured doublet, as did the guard that sat beside him atop the carriage, cradling a crossbow that looked as though it could put a hole the size of a temple window into whatever it was loosed at.
"Hey there!" cried a thin man beside the road. He wore an oil cloak flung back from his shoulders, and there was a larger man on the ground beside him. "Help us, please!"
Ordinarily, the driver would have whipped his team forward and raced past anyone attempting to stop them, but everything seemed wrong for an ambush. The ground here was flat for hundreds of yards around, and if these men were decoys, they couldn't have any allies within 1/2 mile. And their aspect seemed genuinely bedraggled. No armor, no weapons, none of the cocksure bravado of the true marauder. The driver pulled on the reins.
"What do you think you're doing?" said the crossbowman. "Don't get your cock tied in a knot," said the driver. "You're here to watch my back, aren't you? Stranger, what goes?" "Shipwreck!" cried the thin man. He was scruffy-looking, of middle height, with light brown hair pulled loosely back at the neck. "Last night, we got washed ashore."
"What ship?"
"Volantine's Resolve, out of Carthane."
"Is your friend hurt?"
"He's out cold. Are you bound for La Chaine?"
"Aye, 26 miles by road. Be there tomorrow. What would you have of us?"
"Carry us, on horses or on your tailboard. Our master's syndicate has a shipping agent in La Chaine. He can pay for your trouble."
"Driver?" came a sharp, reedy voice from within the carriage. "It's not my business to supply rescue to those witless enough to meet disaster on the Amethel, of all places. Pray for their good health if you must, but move on."
"Sir," said the driver, "the fellow on the ground looks in a bad way. His nose is as purple as grapes."
"That's not my concern."
"There are certain rules," said the driver, "to how we behave out here, sir. And I'm sorry to have to refuse your command, but we'll be on our way again soon."
"I won't pay to feed them, and I won't pay for the time we're losing by sitting here."
"Sorry again, sir. It's got to be done."
"You're right," said the crossbowman with a sigh. "These fellows ain't no highwaymen."
The driver and the guard climbed down from their seat and walked over to where Locke stood over Jean.
"If you could just help me haul him to his feet," said Locke to the crossbowman, "we can try and bring him around."
"Beg pardon, stranger," said the crossbowman. "It's plain foolishness to set a loaded piece down. Takes nothing to set one off by accident. One nudge from a false step."
"Well, just point it away from us," muttered the driver.
"Are you drunk? This one time in Tamalek I saw a fellow set a crossbow down for Juster."
"I'm sure you're right," said the driver testily. "Never, ever set that weapon down for as long as you live. You might accidentally hit some fellow in Tamalek."
The guard sputtered, sighed, and carefully pointed the weapon at a patch of roadside sand. There was a loud, flat crack, and the quarrel was safely embedded in the ground up to its feathers. Thus it was accomplished. Jean miraculously returned to life, and with a few quick swings of his fists he eloquently convinced the two guards to lie down and be unconscious for a while.
"I am really, really sorry about this," said Locke, "and you should know that's not how it normally goes with us." "Well, how now, tender hearts?" shouted the man within the carriage. "Shows what you know, eh? If you had any god's damned brains, you'd be inside one of these things, not driving it."
"They can't hear you," said Locke.
"Marauders, sons of filth, motherless bastards!"
The man inside the box cackled.
"It's all one to me, though. You can't break in here. Steal whatever you like from my gutless hirelings, sirrahs, but you'll not have anything of mine."
"Gods above," said Locke. "Listen up, you heartless fucking weasel. Your fortress has wheels on it. About a mile to the east there are cliffs above the Amethel. We'll unhitch you there and give your box a good shove over the edge."
"I don't believe you."
"Then you'd better practice flying."
Locke hopped up to the driver's seat and took the reins. "Come on, let's take shit sauce here for the shortest trip of his life." Jean climbed up beside Locke. Locke urged the well-trained horses forward, and the coach began to roll.
"Now wait a minute!"
their suddenly unwilling passenger bellowed.
"Stop! Stop! Stop!"
Locke let him scream for about 100 yards before he slowed the team back down.
"If you want to live," said Locke, "go ahead and open the..."
The door banged open. The man who came out was about 60, short and oval-bellied, with the eyes of a startled rabbit. His hat and dressing gown were crimson silk studded with gold buttons. Locke jumped down and glowered at him.
"Take that ludicrous thing off," he growled.
The man quickly stripped to his undertunic. Locke gathered his finery, which reeked of sweat, and threw it into the carriage.
"Where's the food and water?"
The man pointed to a storage compartment built into the outside rear of the carriage, just above the tailboard. Locke opened it, selected a few things for himself, then threw some of the neatly wrapped ration packages onto the dirt beside the road.
"Go wake your friends up and enjoy the walk," said Locke as he climbed back up beside Jean. "Shouldn't be more than a day or so until you reach the outer hamlets of Lachaine. Or maybe someone will come along and take pity on you."
"You bastards!"
shouted the de-robed, de-carriaged man.
"Thieving bastards! You'll hang for this! I'll see it done!"
"That's a remote possibility," said Locke. "But you know what's a certainty? Next fire I need to start, I'm using your clothes to do it, asshole!"
He gave a cheery wave, and then the armored coach service was gathering speed along the road, bound not for Lachaine but Carthane, the long way around the Amethel. Interlude. Orin and Amadine. 1.
"Why in all the hells do you take this abuse?" said Jean as he and Genora sat together over coffee the second morning after the arrival of the gentleman bastards in Aspara. "Dealing with Moncrane, the debts, the bullshit."
"Those of us left are the stakeholders," said Genora. "We own shares in the common property, and shares of the profits, when those miraculously appear. Some of us saved for years to make these investments. If we walk away from Moncrane, we forfeit everything."
"Ah."
"Look at Alondo. He had a wild night at cards, and he used the take to buy his claim in the troop.
That was 3 years ago. We were doing 10 honest turncoats then, and 1,000 swords for Therimpel and the all-murderer's ball. 12 full productions a year, masks for Countess Antonia, festival plays, and we were touring out west, where the countryside's not the god's damned waste it is between here and Camor. I mean, we had prospects. We weren't out of our minds.
I never said you were.
It's mostly hard players and the short-timers that evaporated on us. They don't have any anchors except a weekly wage, and they can make that with Basanti. Hell, they'd happily take less from him, because at least they're sure to play.
What happened?
I don't know, she said, staring into her mug as though it might conceal new answers. I guess sometimes there's just a darkness in someone. You hope it'll go away.
Moncrane, you mean?
If you could have seen him back in those days, I think you'd understand. You know about the 40 corpses?
If I say no, do I become the 41st?
If I killed people, glass eyes, Moncrane wouldn't have lived long enough to be arrested. The 40 corpses is what we call the 40 famous plays that survived the fall of the Empire. The big ones by all the famous throne Therins, Lucarno, Viscora, that bunch.
Oh, said Jean.
They're called corpses because they haven't changed for 4 or 5 centuries. I mean, we love them, most of them, but they do moulder a bit. They get recited like temple ritual, dry and lifeless. Except when Moncrane was on, when Moncrane was good, he made the corpses jump out of their graves. It was like he was a spark and the whole troop would catch fire from it. And when you've seen that, when you've been a part of it, I tell you, Giovanno, you'd put up with nearly anything if only you could have it again.
I am returned, boomed a voice from the inn-yard door, from the exile to which my pride had sentenced me.
Oh, gods below, you people actually did it, said Janora, leaping out of her chair. A man entered the common room, a big dark Seresti in dirty clothing, and cried out when he saw her.
"Janora, my dusky vision! I knew that I could—"
Whatever he'd known was lost as Janora's open palm slammed into his cheek. Jean blinked. Her arm had been a pale brown arc. He made a mental note that she was quick when angered.
"Jasma!" she hollered. "You stupid, stubborn, bottle-sucking, hard-witted fuck! You nearly ruined us! It wasn't your damn pride that put you in jail, it was your fists!"
"Peace, Janora," muttered Moncrane. "Ow! I was sort of quoting a play."
"Ah!"
screamed Mistress Gloriano, rushing in from a side hall.
"I don't believe it! The Camorri got you out! And it's more than you deserve, you lousy wretch! You lousy Seresti drunkard!"
"All's well, Auntie. I've already hit him for both of us," said Janora.
"Oh, hell's hungry kittens," muttered Sylvanus, wandering in behind Mistress Gloriano.
His bloodshot eyes and sleep-swept hair gave him the look of a man who'd been caught in a windstorm.
"I see the guards at the Weeping Tower can be bribed after all."
"Good morning to you too, Andrassus," said Moncrane. "It warms the deep crevices of my heart to hear so many possible explanations for my release, except the thought that I might be innocent."
"You're as innocent as we convinced Bulidazi to pretend you are," said Sabatha, entering from the street. She and Locke had left early that morning to hover around the Weeping Tower, ready to snatch Moncrane up as soon as he was released following his appearance in court.
"He did say some unexpected and handsome things," said Moncrane. "You going to call the meeting to order?" said Sabatha. "Or should I?"
"I can break the news, Verena. Thank you kindly."
Moncrane cleared his throat.
"A moment of your time, gentlemen and ladies of the Moncrane Company. And you as well, Andrassus. And our, benefactor and patient creditor, Mistress Gloriano. There are some changes in the offing."
"Sweet gods," said Sylvanus, "you cold-skinned, life-ruining bastard, are you actually suggesting that gainful employment is about to get its hands around our throats again?"
"Sylvanus, I love you as I love my own Seresti blood," said Moncrane. but shut your dribbling booze hole. And yes, Espara will have its production of the Moncrane Company's The Republic of Thieves.
Sabatha coughed.
I am compelled, however, to accept certain arrangements, continued Moncrane. Lord Bulidazi's agreed to reconsider my, refusal of his patronage offer. Once Salvard has the papers ready, we're the Moncrane Bulidazi Company.
A patron? Said Mistress Gloriano in disbelief. Does this mean we might get paid back for our...
Yes, said Locke, strolling in from the inn-yard with several purses in his hands. And here's yours.
Gandalo's privates, boy!
She caught the jingling bag Locke threw at her.
I simply don't believe it!
Your counting house will believe it for you, said Locke. That's 12 royals to square you. Lord Bulidazi's buying out Master Moncrane's debts to relieve him of the suffering brought on by their contemplation.
To wind a cord about my legs so he can fly me like a kite, said Moncrane through gritted teeth.
To keep you from getting knifed in a god's damned alley, said Sabatha.
Not that this isn't miraculous, said Janora, but those of us with shares in the company have precedence over any arrangement Bulidazi might have proposed. Noble or not, we have papers he can't just piss on.
I realize that, said Locke. We're not here to pry your shares out from under you. Bulidazi is giving Moncrane the funds he needs as an advance against Moncrane's future shares of the company's profits. Your interest is protected.
That's as may be, said Janora. But if this company is back on a paying basis, I want another set of eyes on the books. No offense, Jasma, but strange things can happen to profits before they reach the stakeholders.
The one for figures is Giovanno, said Locke. He's a genius with them.
Hey, thanks for volunteering me, said Jean. I was wondering when I could stop doing interesting things and go bury myself in account ledgers.
I meant it as a compliment. Besides, given a choice, would you rather trust me or the Asinos?
Damn it, Jean growled. I'll see to the books.
Master Moncrane, said Locke. This, by the way, is my cousin, Giovanno de Barra.
The third of the mysterious Camorrii, said Jasma. And where are 4 and 5?
The Asino brothers are still asleep, said Jean. And when they wake, I expect they'll be hungover. They crossed bottles with that thing.
He gestured at Sylvanus.
It was all I could to keep them alive.
Well, then, said Moncrane. Let us yet be merciful. I'm for a bath and fresh clothes. Someone hunt down Alondo, and we'll have our proper meeting about the play after luncheon. How's that sound?
Moncrane!
The street door burst inward, propelled by a kick from an unpleasant-looking man. His expensive clothes were stained with wine, sauces, and ominous dark patches that had nothing to do with food. Half a dozen men and women followed him into the room, clearly assorted species of leg-breakers. The right people of Espara were on the scene.
"Oh, good morning, Shepherd. Can I offer you some
"Moncrane," said the man called Shepherd. "You sack of dried-up horse-cunt leather! Did you stop at a counting-house after your escape from the Weeping Tower?"
"I haven't had time, but..."
"At some point, Moncrane, compound interest becomes less interesting to my boss than shoving you up a dead horse's ass and sinking you in a fucking swamp."
"Excuse me," said Locke meekly.
"Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't realize it was the children's festival this week," said Shepherd. "You looking for an ass-kicking or what?"
"Can I ask how much Master Moncrane owes your boss?"
18 royals, 4/5, 36 coppins, accurate to this very hour."
"Thought so. There's 19 in this bag," said Locke, holding out a leather purse. "From Moncrane, of course. He just likes to draw these things out, you know, for dramatic effect."
"This a fucking joke?"
19 royals, said Locke. "No joke."
Shepherd slipped the purse open, ran his fingers through the coins inside, and gave a startled grunt.
"Strange days are upon us," he snapped the purse shut. "Signs and wonders. Jasma Moncrane has paid a debt. I'd say my fucking prayers tonight, I would."
"Are we square?" said Moncrane.
"Square?" said Shepherd. "Yeah, this matter's closed. But don't come crawling back for more, Moncrane. Not for a few months, at least. Let the boss forget what a degenerate ass canker you are."
"Sure," said Moncrane. "Just as you say."
"Of course, if you had any brains at all, you'd never risk the chance of seeing me again."
Shepherd sketched a salute in the air, turned and left along with his crew of thugs, most of whom looked disappointed.
"A word," said Moncrane, leading Locke off to one side of the room. "While I'm pleased as a baby on a breast to have that weight lifted, I begin to wonder if I'm meant to be nothing but a mute witness to my own affairs from now on. If you'd had your way, you'd be starting your real prison sentence today," said Locke. "You can't blame us for wanting to keep you out of further trouble. I'm not pleased to be treated like I can't handle simple business. Give me the purses you have left, and I'll dispense with my own debts. The tailor, the bootmaker, the scrivener, and the actors that left for Bassanti's company? We can hunt them down ourselves, thank you."
"They're not your accounts to close, boy!"
"And this isn't your money to hold," said Locke.
"Jasmer," said Sabitha, coming up behind them with Jean in tow, "I'd hate to think that you were trying to corner and intimidate one of us privately."
"We were merely discussing how I might take responsibility for my own shortcomings," said Moncrane.
"You can hold to the deal," said Sabitha, "and remember who got you out of the Weeping Tower and brought in our new patron. Your job is to give us a play. Where that's concerned, we're your subjects, but where your safety is concerned, you're ours."
"Well," said Moncrane, "don't I feel enfolded in the bosom of love itself?"
"Just try not to screw anything else up," said Sabitha. "It won't be that hard a life."
"I'll go have my bath, then," said Moncrane. "Would the three of you care to watch to make sure I don't drown myself?"
"If you do that," said Locke, "you'd never have the satisfaction of bossing us around on stage."
"True enough."
Moncrane scratched at his dark grey stubble.
"See you after luncheon, then. Oh, since these are matters relating to the play, Lucasa, get a dozen chairs from the common room and set them out in the inn yard. Verena, dig through the common property to find all the copies of the Republic of Thieves we have. Janora can lend you a hand."
"Of course," said Sabitha.
"Good. Now, if I'm wanted for any further business, I'll be in my room with no clothes on."
2. Just before noon, the sun passed behind a thick bank of clouds, and its brain-poaching heat was cut to a more bearable, lazy warmth. The mud of the inn-yard, late resting place of the very pickled Silvanus Olivius Andrassus, had dried to a soft crust beneath the feet of the excited and bewildered Moncrane Bulidazi company. All five gentlemen bastards had seats, though Carlo and Galdo, with dark patches under their eyes, pointedly refused to sit together, and so bookended Locke, Jean, and Sabitha. Alondo flipped idly through a torn and stained copy of The Republic of Thieves. Each volume in the little stack of scripts found by Sabitha was a different size, and no two had been copied in the same hand. Some were marked Moncrane Company, or Scribed for J. Moncrane, while others were the ex-property of other troops. One even bore the legend Bassanti on its back cover. Silvanus, sober, or at least not actively imbibing, sat next to Janora. Alondo's cousin stood against a wall, arms folded. This, then, was the complete roster of the company. Locke sighed.
"Hello again."
Moncrane appeared, looking almost respectable in a quilted grey doublet and black breeches.
"Now, let us discover together which of history's mighty entities are sitting with us, and which ones we shall have to beg, borrow, or steal. You."
"Me, sir?" said Alondo's cousin.
"Yes. Who in all the hells are you? Are you a Camorri?"
"Oh, gods above, no, sir. I'm Alondo's cousin."
"Got a name?"
"Junkar Curlin. Everyone calls me Donker."
"Bad fucking luck. You an actor?"
"No, sir, a hostler."
"What do you mean by spying on my company's meeting like this?"
I just want to get killed on stage, sir.
Fuck the stage. Come here and I'll grant your wish right now.
He means, said Jean, that we promised him a bit part in exchange for helping us sell off some surplus horse flesh.
Oh, said Moncrane, an enthusiast. I'd be very pleased to help you die on stage. Stay on my good side, and it can even be pretend.
Thank you, sir.
Now, said Moncrane, we need ourselves an Orin. Orin is a young man of Therimpel, basically good-hearted, unsure of himself. He's also the only son and heir to the Emperor. Looks like we've got a surplus of young men, so you can all fight it out over the next few days, and we'll need an Amadine.
Hey, said Carlo, sorry to interrupt. I was just wondering, before we all get measured for codpieces or whatever, where the hell are we supposed to be giving this play? I hear this Bassanti has a theatre of his own. What do we have?
You're one of the Asino brothers, right? Said Moncrane.
Giacomo Asino.
Well, being from Camor, Giacomo, you probably don't know about the Old Pearl. It's a public theatre built by some count. Paul Doris the Just, muttered Sylvanus. Built by Poldaris the Just, said Moncrane, as his perpetual legacy to the people of Espara. Big stone amphitheatre about 200 years old. 188, said Sylvanus. Apologies, Sylvanus. Unlike you, I wasn't there. So you see, Giacomo, we can use it as long as we pay a little fee to the Countess Envoy of Ceremonies.
If it's such a fine place, why did Bassanti build his own?
The Old Pearl is perfectly adequate, said Moncrane. Bassanti built to flatter his self-regard, not fatten his pocketbook.
Because businessmen like to spend lots of money to replace perfectly adequate structures they can use for nearly nothing, right?
Look, boy, said Moncrane. It wouldn't matter if Bassanti's new theatre turned dog turds into platinum while merely setting foot inside the Old Pearl gave people leprosy. The Old Pearl's it. There's no time or money for anything else.
Does it? Said Carlo. Give people leprosy, I mean?
Go lick the stage and find out. Now, let's talk about Amadine. Amadine is a thief in a time of peace and abundance. Therimpel has grown a crop of bandits in the ancient catacombs beneath the city. They mock the customs of the upright people, of the emperor and his nobles. Some of them even call their little world a republic. Amadine is their leader.
You should be our Amadine, Jasma, said Sylvanus. Think of the pretty skirts Janora could sew for you.
Verena's our Amadine, said Moncrane. There's a certain deficiency of breasts in the company, and while yours may be larger than hers, Sylvanus, I doubt as many people would pay to see them. No, since our former Amadine abandoned us, she'll do.
Sabatha gave a slight, satisfied nod.
Now, everyone take a copy of the lines. Have them out for consultation. A troupe learns a play like we all learn to screw, stumbling and jostling until everything's finally in the right place.
Locke felt his cheeks warm a bit, though the sun was still hidden away behind the high wall of summer clouds.
So, Orin falls for Amadine, and they have lots of problems, and it's all very romantic and tragic, and the audience gives us ever so much money to see it, said Moncrane. But to get there, we've got to sharpen things to a fine point, slash some dead weight from the text. I'll give you full cuts later, but for now I think we can discard all the bits with Marolus the courtier. And we'll cut Avunculo and Twitch, the comic relief thieves, for a certainty.
Aye, a certainty, said Sylvanus. And what a bold decision that is, given that Amarolus, Avunculo, and Twitch all ran across town chasing Bassanti's coin when you took up Les Majestés as a new hobby.
Thank you, Andrassus, said Moncrane. You'll have many weeks to belittle my every choice.
don't spend yourself in one afternoon. Now you, Asino.
Castellano, said Galdo, yawning.
Castellano, stand up. Wait, you can read, can't you? You can all read, I assume.
Reading. Is that where you draw pictures with chalk or where you bang a stick on a drum? Said Galdo. I get confused.
The first thing that happens, said Moncrane with a scowl, the first character the audience meets is the chorus. Out comes the chorus. Give us his lines, Castellano.
Said Galdo, staring down at his little book.
What the fuck's the matter with you, boy? Shouted Moncrane. Who says when they've got the script in their hands? If you say in front of 500 people, I guarantee that some unwashed wine-sucking cow down in the penny pit will throw something at you. They wait on any excuse.
Sorry, said Galdo. He cleared his throat and read. You see us wrong who see with your eyes, and hear nothing true, though straining your ears. What thieves of wonder are these poor senses, whispering, this stage is wood, these men are dust, and dust their deeds, these centuries gone.
No, said Jasmer. What do you mean, no? You're reciting, not orating. The chorus is a character. The chorus, in his own mind, is flesh and blood. He's not reading lines out of a little book. He's on a mission.
If you say so, said Galdo.
Sit down, said Moncrane. Other Asino, stand up. Can you do better than your brother?
Just ask the girls he's been with, said Carlo.
Give us a chorus.
Carlo stood up, straightened his back, puffed out his chest, and began to read loudly, clearly, emphasizing words that Galdo had read flatly.
You see us wrong, who see with your eyes, and hear nothing true, though straining your ears. What thieves of wonder are these poor senses whispering?
Enough, said Jasmer.
Better. You're giving it rhythm, stressing the right words, orating with some little competence, but you're still just reciting the words as though they were ritual in a book.
They are just words in a book, said Carlo.
They are a man's words, said Moncrane. They are a man's words, not some dull formula. Put flesh and blood behind them, else why should anyone pay to see on stage what they could read quietly for themselves?
Because they can't fucking read, said Galdo.
Stand up again, Castellano. No, no, Giacomo, don't sit down. I want you both for this. I'll show you my point so that even Camorri dullards can take it to heart. Castellano, go over to your brother. Keep your script in hand. You are angry with your brother, Castellano, angry at what a dunce he is. He doesn't understand these lines, so now you will show him.
Moncrane steadily raised his voice.
Correct him! Perform them to him as though he is an idiot! You see us wrong, who see with your eyes, said Galdo.
He gestured disdainfully at his own face with his free hand, and took two threatening steps closer to Carlo.
And hear us not at all, though straining your ears.
He reached out and snapped a finger against one of Carlo's ears. The long-haired twin recoiled, and Galdo moved aggressively toward him once again.
What thieves of wonder are these poor senses, said Galdo, all but hissing with disdain. Whispering! This stage is wood, these men are dust, and dust their deeds, and thousand dust their ducks. Oh, shit, lost myself, sorry.
It's all right, said Moncrane. You had something there, didn't you?
That was fun, said Galdo. I think I see what you mean. Words are dead until you give them a context, said Moncrane. Until you put a character behind them and give him a reason to speak them in a certain fashion.
Can I do it back to him like he's the stupid one? Said Carlo.
No, I've made my point, said Moncrane. You Camorri do have a certain poise and inventiveness.
I just need to awaken you to its proper employment. Now, what's our chorus doing here?
He's pleading, said Jean.
Pleading. Yes, exactly. First thing, out comes the chorus to plead to the crowd, the hot, sweaty, drunk, and skeptical crowd. Listen up, you unworthy fucking mongrels! Look, there's a play going on right in front of you. Shut up and give it the attention it deserves.
Moncrane changed his voice and poise in an instant. Without so much as a glance at the script, he spoke.
What thieves of wonder are these poor senses, whispering, this stage is wood, these men are dust, and dust their deeds these centuries gone. For us it is not so. See now and conjure with present vigor a happy empire. Her foes sleep in ruins of cold ambitions, and take for law the merest whim of all-conquering Salarius. Second of that name, and most imperial to bear it, his youth spent in dreary march and stern discipline, wherein he met the proudest neighbors of his empire, with trampled fields for his court, red swords for ambassador,